Hello and welcome to Florida Politics Reviewed. I'm your host, Nora O'Neill. This is a podcast out of Florida Political Review, Florida's preeminent student political journal. For more in-depth coverage of Florida politics, visit our website, floridapoliticalreview.com, and follow us on Twitter at FLA Review. On today's episode, Florida Representative Matt Gaetz is under investigation for allegedly violating federal sex trafficking laws. Then we will discuss how students are fighting against lawmakers trying to change the Bright Futures scholarship program. After that, we will discuss a new bill meant to combat cancel culture and another bill trying to require a supermajority vote to adopt a single-payer healthcare system. And then we will close the episode with an update on Florida vaccine distributions. We'll get into all this and more on today's episode of Florida Politics Reviewed. Representative Matt Gaetz, a rising GOP star and favorite of former President Donald Trump, is currently under investigation by the Justice Department for allegedly violating federal sex trafficking laws. I'm here with FPR writer Danielle Dietz. How are you today?
I'm great, Nora. Excited to talk with you.
So who exactly is Matt Gaetz?
So Matt Gaetz is a 38-year-old Republican representative who has served Florida's first congressional district since 2017, winning re-election this past November. He's been one of President Trump's most vibrant advocates, gaining fame and admiration from the far right through his animated support of the president in recent years. For instance, following the most recent general election, Gaetz jumped to defend the former president's touting of the big lie and claims of election fraud, despite a lack of evidence. He recently also garnered praise from the far right following his participation in a Wyoming rally aimed at unseating Representative Liz Cheney. Cheney, who is the House Republican conference chair, the third highest position in the House Republican leadership, was one of only 10 Republicans to vote to impeach Donald Trump following the incitement of the insurrection, something which angered those who subscribe to what has become known as Trumpism.
So explain how this investigation into Gaetz started.
So the Justice Department actually began the investigation in the last few months of Trump's term under then acting Attorney General William Barr. According to the New York Times, a number of senior officials were briefed on the investigation due to Representative Gaetz's increasing spotlight within the party and his growing national profile. The investigation into Gaetz, according to the Times, was only a result of a larger indictment against a local Florida official, Joel Greenberg. Joel Greenberg, who is the former Seminole County tax collector, was indicted last year on charges of sex trafficking of a minor, stalking a political rival, and financially supporting people in exchange for sex. A new indictment released Tuesday also includes charges of wire fraud, conspiracy to bribe a public official, and theft of government property.
And what crimes did Gaetz allegedly commit?
So, allegedly, Gaetz was engaged in a sexual relationship with a girl who was 17 years old at the time. Over the course of this relationship, it is also alleged that he paid for her to travel with him across state lines. Beyond the obvious problematic nature of those claims, there are numerous federal statutes prohibiting the inducing of minors to travel over state lines for sex in exchange for money or valuable assets. Furthering the potential for this investigation, the Justice Department is also investigating whether or not campaign funds were used to pay these expenses. Sort of ironically, and especially damning in regard to these allegations, Gaetz was the only member of Congress to vote against a 2017 law intended to aid the federal government in curbing human trafficking.
And so what does Gaetz have to say about these accusations?
So Gaetz has repeatedly denied these allegations, claiming they're part of a $25 million extortion plot against him and his family. This is an especially interesting take because even if true, at least to me, extortion corroborates something being amiss, or at least it's a very rare case when it doesn't. Although it's unclear whether or not Gaetz was aware of the investigation at the time, on April 6th, the Times reported that Gaetz had previously asked former President Trump to preemptively pardon him of any crimes he may or may not have committed.
You can read more about this story by searching Danielle's name, Danielle, D-I-E-T-Z, on the FPR website. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thanks.
Students are fighting against Florida lawmakers and their efforts to modify the merit scholarship Bright Futures. I'm here with everyone's favorite FPR writer, Andrew Taramikin. How are you today?
As good as ever.
So let's start by talking about the bill, SB 86, and the different phases it has gone through.
So essentially, SB 86 was filed at the beginning of the legislative session by Senator Dennis Baxley, a Republican from Ocala. And the bill was really controversial for a number of significant overhauls it proposed to the state's Bright Future Scholarship Program. It's the premier merit-based student financial aid for the state of Florida. It currently funds over 100,000 students' education annually and growing each year. So anything touching Bright Futures is kind of a third rail just to begin with. And SB 86 did a lot. So not only did it, the first measure was simply it changed the way Bright Futures would be funded from being from the Florida Lottery and paying for full tuition for students who earn it to being from general appropriations, which would mean the state could set how much money is allocated every year and not necessarily guarantee students full scholarships, which in and of itself was controversial. But the real kicker was the state wanted to restrict funds based on majors that lead directly to employment. So the Board of Governors would essentially establish a list of degree programs that were worthy of full scholarships, and degree programs that weren't on that list would not get as much money. And that really drew an uproar, students feeling as though, you know, they deserved to get what they earned, you know, regardless of what they wanted to study. In addition, it would also reduce payment for students who had advanced credits from high school through programs such as AP or IB. It basically would caused significant changes, widely viewed as significant reductions in how much money would be available. But there was, Baxley even admitted in a Senate committee hearing that there was no guarantee that it was even going to save the state money. Baxley claims the purpose of the bill was to connect education to the real world, but there were a lot of concerns protesters had with it. So initially, Baxley delayed the bill, kind of softened some of the language, went into an education hearing. It was a contentious hearing, but it passed on party lines. It advanced to the Appropriations Committee, but on March 22nd, Senator Baxley filed a strike all amendment, eliminating most of the most controversial measures in the bill, including the Board of Governors designating which majors deserve what funding, eliminating the provisions that would reduce credits for students who had AP credits. Essentially, what SB 86 really does now is moves Bright Futures into general appropriations, which is still a dicey decision, but it passed the Appropriations Committee and is now going to be debated on the Senate floor. Actually, by the time this episode is aired, I believe it will have been debated on the Senate floor already. So it's pretty much at the final stages in the state Senate. State House is another story. So
it's clear to see why students would be outraged over this bill. Tell me a little bit about the backlash it's gotten from students and the Save Bright Futures movement.
So the Save Bright Futures movement was really digital grassroots in pretty much its purest form. I had the opportunity to speak to three students who lead the Save Bright Futures social media accounts. Ronan Lupien, he is a freshman at the University of Florida, and Thomas Truong and Shahir Ali, they're juniors at Lake Nona High School in Orlando. None of them are political operatives or activists by trade. They have some volunteer experience here and there, but for the most part, not really. And they just made Instagram posts, and their friends shared those posts on their Instagram stories, and mutual friends shared it. And, you know, as things snowball on social media, things snowballed. And basically they kind of realized, like, hey, we got a decent following, we should put this together. So they teamed up, them and some other students. They compiled an Instagram account, Twitter account. They made a website. They've compiled resources, contact for senators, both on the Education Committee, as well as the author of the bill, Senator Baxley, the president of the Senate, Wilton Simpson. So they really kind of put the tools together to help students just like them, just regular students, really rally against this bill that they kind of saw as untenable. There was kind of a widespread agreement that they're like, we and all our friends, we've been working, you know, for years for this. And this is what makes, you know, this is what makes going to school in Florida attractive to us. This is how a lot of us are planning to pay for college. A lot of students at the University of Florida, myself included, you know, get their education funded by Bright Futures. So it's obviously a personal topic for a lot of these kids, and they really view it that way. You know, when you talk to them, they're not kind of throwing around political buzzwords. They're really just saying, like, this matters to us. And it's really impressive to see how well they've organized that. They're trying to reach out more on college campuses. They were trying to reach out to parents, obviously, because parents may be, you know, as voters, better to pressure legislators, especially from the high school perspective. They're trying to reach out to college campuses, trying to get support from student governments at the large state universities. And a few student body presidents have expressed support. Not all. Some have ignored. Some have declined. But they're really trying to get this kind of broad coalition push to restrict the bill, and signs indicate that it's working because, you know, Senator Baxley had the votes in the state Senate. It sailed through the first committee. It had the president's support, so it was looking like it was going to pass through the Senate. But just this kind of grassroots organization really seems to pressure over and over a continual restructuring of the bill. Eventually, the strike all amendment filed on the 22nd. Obviously, they're still not happy with the bill being, with Bright Futures being under general appropriations, but it really has been an impressive kind of upswell of voices from students and from young people.
And so what does the future look like for this bill?
So like I've kind of suggested, it has the votes in the Senate. Wilton Simpson supports it. Obviously, Dennis Baxley supports it. It's made it through the Appropriations and Education Committees. So it has pretty good chances of passing the Florida Senate. The Florida House has no companion bill. Chris Latvala, the chairman of the House Education and Employment Committee, has no interest in pursuing it. House Speaker Chris Sproules has shown no interest in pursuing it. And Governor Ron DeSantis says he supports Bright Future being fully funded. So in the Senate, things look really good for SB 86. And at first, it looked like a really uphill battle for the Save Bright Futures movement. But in the other kind of states of the state government that have to get behind it, it doesn't look like it has much of a chance. And this kind of gets into some of the dynamics of how state politics works in Florida. The leaders of the chambers have a lot of power. And, you know, obviously, we don't necessarily know senators' individual motivations, but if I had to speculate, I would suppose that the vocal support of President Simpson is a big part of why it's done so well in the Senate, because some senators have voted for the bill in their committees, but expressed a lot of concerns about it. So that kind of shows you that, you know, it may be passing because, you know, the institutional clout in that chamber is supporting it. In the House, it doesn't have that support from the Speaker. And in the executive branch, it doesn't have that support from Governor DeSantis. So the future for SB 86 is ultimately grim in the grand scheme of things.
Mm-hmm. You can find Andrew on Twitter at Andrew Taramikin. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Republican lawmakers in Florida have proposed Senate Bill 264 attempting to combat political bias in public universities by fostering intellectual freedom and viewpoint diversity. I'm here with FPR writer Shayna Shulman. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. So the hot topic of this bill is what Republicans are calling cancel culture. Can you explain what they mean by this?
So cancel culture has been quite the buzzword recently. It means that individuals who have views or opinions that are deemed as not part of the liberal mainstream are quote unquote canceled for their opinions. A survey conducted at the University of North Carolina found that students across the political spectrum actually engage in self-censorship in the classroom for fear that they could face retaliation from their professors or their peers. But a significantly higher percentage of conservatives self-censor.
You write that this bill has three components. What are those?
The first component would require public universities in Florida to conduct an annual assessment of the competing ideas that are presented on college campuses and how free people feel to express their beliefs. I was actually able to speak with the bill's sponsor, Senator Rodriguez himself, and he said that if we have diversity on these campuses, that's great. We would celebrate that. But if we don't, that's something that the community and the Board of Governors will work to improve. The second component is that it would prohibit public universities from shielding students from certain speech that's protected under the First Amendment. So this would mean that public universities can't prevent someone from speaking on campus simply because they disagree with their views or they find it to be uncomfortable, unwelcome, or offensive. The last part of the bill is that it allows students to record their professors in classrooms. If the student feels like a professor is imposing their political views on them, then that student would be legally allowed to record the interaction.
What are some concerns that people have about this bill?
So when I spoke with Senator Tina Polsky, she told me that she has concerns about how to protect freedom of speech, but also make sure that students are safe. She voted against the bill in a Senate committee because she believes that universities should further knowledge and hateful groups or individuals should not be allowed on campus. I also spoke with Clay Calvert, who's a UF professor and the director of the First Amendment Project. He was adamant that if the bill's purpose is to inform us about First Amendment free speech protections, then that's great. However, he did express concerns that the bill could make professors self-censor their classroom materials for fear of losing their job.
So where is the bill at now?
The bill has already been passed by the House and it cleared through three Senate committees. Currently, the bill is moving through the Senate and there's a committee substitute moving through the Florida House. If passed, Senate Bill 264 is set to become effective on July 1st, 2021.
You can find more of Shayna's work on the Florida Political Review website by searching her name, Shayna Shulman. Thanks so much for being here. A new amendment to the Florida Constitution that would raise the vote margin needed to adopt a single-payer healthcare system is moving toward passage by the State Senate. The joint resolution is titled SJR 340. I'm here with FPR writer Lily Cairns. How are you today, Lily?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. So, who is behind this new amendment?
The amendment was authored by Senator Manny Diaz of Hialeah, Florida, and he is a Republican senator who has been elected to the Senate since 2012. He is definitely conservative. He follows his party platform. Notably, he's penned multiple other bills similar to SJR 140, which we'll be discussing today, that are specifically economically conservative.
And what exactly does this amendment call for?
So the bill would amend Article 3 of the Florida State Constitution to require a supermajority vote. So two-thirds of both the House and the Senate to pass single-payer health care in the state, across the state. And that would mean centralizing the entire health care system.
And where is this resolution at right now?
So the resolution passed through two specifically Senate subcommittees first before on March 11th, being voted 11 to 6 by the Committee on Appropriations favorably. So now it is in the Committee on Rules. And after the Committee on Rules, it's likely to go to the floor of the House, or excuse me, the Senate.
When we talk about single-payer healthcare, at least in this context, we're often referring to the Medicare for All platform held by a lot of progressives. What does this amendment say about the attitude of conservatives in the Florida legislature?
Well, the bill was only introduced in late December of last year, and it's run through the Senate subcommittees and committees very quickly. The Florida legislature has been held by Republicans, along with the governorship, for as long as I've been alive, longer than I've been alive, actually. But it indicates a bit of wariness of both waves of support that we're seeing nationally for sort of nationalized healthcare, and probably a fear that the historical swing state that is Florida might flip its own legislature blue.
And so what is the likelihood of this amendment, SJR 340, passing?
So the bill will likely be passed by the Senate once it reaches the floor, and the House will also likely pass its own counterpart when that reaches the floor of the House. DeSantis, as governor, will likely sign the bill. However, because it is not just a law, it's an amendment to the Constitution of Florida, every voter who votes in the next election, or who votes in the election that this bill is on the ballot, has a say in whether or not it gets put into the Constitution. The way that the Florida voting body is split up favors Democratic registered voters by 100,000 over Republican registered voters. However, there are 3 million independent voters, registered voters. And how those independents vote could turn the tide.
You can also read more about the conversation and context surrounding single-payer healthcare in Lily's latest story on floridapoliticalreview.com. And to close the show off, we have a quick update on vaccinations in Florida. I'm here with FPR writer Misha. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you for asking. It's great to be back on another session with you.
So we have some great news this week, and that is that Governor Ron DeSantis declared all Florida adults eligible for the vaccine starting earlier this week on April 5th. What about Florida residents who are under 18?
Well, Florida residents aged 16 and 17 may also get their vaccine, but it will be much more difficult for them to find a dose. Primarily, Pfizer is the only approved vaccine for those ages, and there are limited locations in Florida that offer it at the moment, unfortunately. However, experts say that there are several studies being done in order to find the effectiveness and safety of vaccines for younger ages. So there is hope.
And what have Florida vaccination efforts looked like up until this point?
Well, as many of us know, Florida is one of the most populated states with senior residents, and the most risk demographic by COVID is the elderly. Therefore, Florida has thus far prioritized vaccinations for senior residents through innovative pilot programs, pushing Florida ahead of most states in availability. DeSantis even praised the fact that more than 3.2 million people aged 65 and older have been vaccinated, and that case rates and hospitalizations have significantly decreased for seniors. Because of Florida's seniors first vaccine strategy and the success it has showcased, availability is increasing to even younger age groups.
And so what pushed DeSantis to lower the eligibility age?
There are actually multiple factors that come to mind on the spot. Firstly, a big key reason is due to the success of Florida's seniors first vaccine strategy, like I mentioned before. But there are other reasons, and one of them being because there have been more and more doses available. For example, an increase in shipments of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine has already arrived in Florida. And according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, a total of approximately, I believe it was around 700,000 vaccine doses were allocated in Florida in the past week or so. This was an increase of approximately 150,000 from the preceding week. And lastly, there was a lot of pressure from local counties and medical experts that kept pushing for the idea that the age requirement could be significantly lower. A great example of this could be found when Orange County Mayor Jerry Demings lowered the age requirement at the Orange County Convention Center vaccination site to 40 and older, which directly contradicted regulations provided by the state government. There was an executive order by DeSantis that required age eligibility to be 50 and up, and therefore tensions began to skyrocket as many other counties wanted to mimic Orange County policies.
So how many people are currently vaccinated in Florida?
I believe it's around 6 million, and the majority being the elderly. Hopefully, the younger age groups will be able to catch up in vaccine numbers sooner rather than later.
And so how can these people register to get the vaccine?
Well, to pre-register for a vaccine, the state has created a portal in myvaccine.fl.gov for any Floridian adults aged 18 years or older. After pre-registration, you will be contacted about the vaccine availability in your area. Those with more questions about vaccine pre-registration can contact their county's vaccine pre-registration department, actually.
Thank you so much for being here. Where can we find your work?
Of course, you can find it on floridapoliticalreview.com. My name is Mikhail Mikhailov, aka Misha, aka Good Mishka, and it's been my pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. That's it for the show today. And this is the final episode of season one of the podcast. We're taking a short break and we'll be back in May with new episodes. Until then, you can stay updated on all things Florida politics by visiting our website, floridapoliticalreview.com, and you can find me on Twitter at NOR O'Neill. Thanks again for listening to Florida Politics Reviewed.